of enjoyment rather than duty, the more happily and easily you'll stay with it. Eventually, these transitional activities become less important. With daily sitting practice, your whole life starts to become a cruise on the freeway, the way of freedom. Yes, old challenges persist and new ones arise. Yes, business must be taken care of. But even as you take care of your business, it all somehow becomes smoother, more frictionless, as if that freeway radiates in all directions and has always just been freshly paved. Not all at once, but more and more, even the fiercest of challenges and most frantic of scenarios seem to have the fierceness and franticness drained out of them. More and more, they're all seen to take place within the sky-like silence. And then, what is there to ramp onto? Chapter 10. Testimony. But does it work? It does. You just need to practice for a little while, and you'll see. Meanwhile, hearing other people's testimony can help encourage you to make the investment of sitting down and taking it easy every day. Traveling from place to place to lead workshops, or reading email from people who've incorporated this way of effortlessness into their lives, I often hear myself thinking, wow, the stuff really does work. Some people's stories are dramatic, like that of the older woman at a workshop in Kansas City, who reported that, during our first meditation, her chronic tremors suddenly stopped. Some stories are deeply moving, like the email I received from a 30-year-old in Utah. He recounted a long odyssey of sexual abuse in his childhood, drug and alcohol addiction in his teens, then several years of trying to meditate before hearing me one night in a radio interview talking about effortlessness. He got one of my audiobooks, then drove around the desert listening to it, occasionally pulling off the road to meditate, and quickly finding the peace and ease he'd been seeking for so long. And some people's stories are written all over them, like the TV producer who sometimes attends our sessions in Santa Monica. Handling complex production logistics, impossibly compressed shooting schedules, and some extremely difficult people, she looked ready to tear her hair out when she first started coming. Now her eyes are bright and calm, her posture relaxed and confident. Nothing need be said. Let's listen to one person's testimony at some length, and, to make it significant, let's choose a hard case. When I first met him, he was in maximum security at Northern State Prison in Newark, New Jersey, considered the roughest institution in the state. Prison is a good place to learn things. It's a lot like everywhere else, only more so. There's certainly plenty of fear, anger, anxiety, and addiction to tackle. I love working with prisoners. The Buddha said to practice like your hair is on fire, and theirs is. They understand the gravity of the situation, and their bullshit detectors are very finely tuned. Our weekly meditation group at Northern State meets in a bare, bunker-like cinder block chapel. We sit in a circle of blue plastic chairs, everyone wearing khaki but me. One night in 2005, one of our regulars brought a new guy along, a young, blue-eyed Puerto Rican with reddish hair and cornrows and tattoos up and down his forearms, one of them reading, "In me I trust." I'll call him Lucio. His body seemed coiled, as if ready at any moment to fight or bolt, and he looked out through hooded eyes that seemed to say, "What the fuck is all this?" But he sat and meditated with us, and he came back the next week. Every Thursday night he came back and meditated, and each time I could see his body relax and his eyes soften a little more. He started to ask questions and to laugh. Out from behind his hard mask emerged a sweet baby face. One night, After about a month, he took me aside at the end of the meeting and said, "I have a question. How do you purify murder?" Before I could answer, he added, "You know, I never trusted anyone, not even my parents, but I trust you." "Uh-oh," I thought. "I better do this right." Over the next 5 years, Lucio became a leading spirit in the group, always making the discussions lively and fun, and, as his own experience and understanding deepened, always eager to help others understand. When I moved to California and the head chaplain couldn't find a replacement for me, he put Lucio in charge of running the group. Lucio also started sending me letters. One day I received a photocopy of his brand new GED certificate and a proud note telling me that he had earned it after teaching himself to read and write so that he could read the books that we talked about in the group. Another time I received a lumpy little package. Inside was his hair in two long braids and a note asking me to donate it to Locks of Love for a child who had lost his hair to chemo. Seeing the sweet soul that was emerging from under all that armor, I wanted to understand how it had gotten buried in the first place. I asked Lucio if he would write out his story, and he did, over the course of a few letters. "When I was 7, playing on a corner, when this guy starts fighting with his girl, the guy ends up smacking her. So the big-time drug dealer came around and told the guy to take that someplace else before you make the block hot," meaning before the police comes around. So the guy said something slick to the drug dealer, and drug dealer knock out the guy. A few days later, on the same corner, the drug dealer was giving me $1 so I could go to the store. The guy he knock out jump out of a car and shot the drug dealer more than 10 times. As he laid there, his body jumping around a little bit, blood was pouring out onto the concrete. The blood started to clot up, but me only being 7, it looked like the fat in pork and bean. The smell of the blood was like a million wet pennies. I ran home before the police came around. At that time, I realized I had blood on me. I felt so bad because I couldn't help the man who gave me $1 every day and told me to stay in school. Now, a week or two later, I'm across the street from the corner when my cousin throw a bottle at some dude. The guy whip out and shot my cousin through the leg, the bullet bounce off the sidewalk, went through my shirt, and hit my friend in the spine. At that time, I wanted to hang out with the people who were doing the shooting because I was scared to get shot. But everybody I was hanging out with was older than me, so I had to do the same things they was doing. I start smoking weed and playing around with stealing cars. Every day I got jumped or just fight until one day you stab someone and no one want to mess with you anymore. At the age of 10, ridiculed by other kids because of his shabby clothes, Lucio dropped out of school and started dealing drugs. Guns came into his life. I had a .38 handgun and loved guns. Every time we got a new gun, we would go to the backyard, shoot them to see if they work. My cousin wanted me to know what shooting something live felt like, so he had me killing dogs and things like that. One day I hear the guns go off in the backyard, so I go back there because I want to test out the new toys, so I thought. My cousin had this guy back there. The dude had took some drug or money. He tell me to shoot him. And I flat out told him no. He grabbed my left hand and beat it with the butt of the gun until my hand broke. I didn't say no to him after that. Before he turned 13, Lucio's mother called the cops on him, and he left the house. He found support for a while from a local church, but when he realized that the minister was sponging money from his poor congregants to pay for fancy clothes and cars, Lucio was disillusioned. By age 14, he tried to kill himself twice, and by 21, he was locked up. "Yes, I was full of rage. Now I'm 30 years old. I've been locked up since I was 21. The first 4 years of me being locked up, I'll go to a tier, have a fight, go to the hole. come back out, and if the guy had beat me up when we had the fight, I'll cut or stab him this time. Around 2005, a friend says, come check out this group. When I get there, I see this white guy saying words I didn't understand and telling us to meditate. After a while, I start to meditate, and I love it. But the more I meditate, the more I reflect on all the bad I have done in the past. And I start to feel about all the people I hurt when I never felt that way because I was full of hate and anger. And I loved feeling hate and anger because I knew hate and anger would never leave me. Hate and anger would stop love from hurting me. At one point, I didn't hear from him for several months. Then I got a letter telling me he had been moved to another prison and put in ADSEG, administrative segregation, a.k.a. solitary confinement, locked away in a cell above the furnace where the temperature was constantly around 100 degrees. So he figured it must be time for a meditation retreat. He stripped off his clothes, sat down, and closed his eyes. Now it's going on 6 years, and it's been the best 6 years of my life. I have a heart and soul full of love. And even though my past was rough, and I made it rougher than it had to be, my past was my hell, and inside me, I've found heaven. Today, Lucio is free, in both senses. After a hard first few years facing the challenges of the outside world, he's now working in construction, living with a wonderful woman, and continuing his meditation practice. He's found a church with sincere leadership and a caring congregation, and he has one new tattoo, a big Buddha across his chest. Chapter 11, Being the Ocean. Let's take another dive into natural meditation. As you saw in our first session back in Chapter 8, this is not something we work at. We just let gravity take over, and settling happens by itself. It's not about doing, but being. So I'm less like the instructor in your Zumba class, now shake it, and more like the tour guide on your trip to Florence. See how it's a nice. Since you now have some familiarity with the terrain, this time we'll visit a little longer than before, and we'll notice a few more features. I'll use a few more words, but nothing I say will be giving you anything to do. I'm just pointing out the sights. As with the earlier meditation, you can return here for subsequent sessions. And, of course, don't do this while driving. So, please sit comfortably with your hands relaxed on your knees or lap. You're now familiar with several meditative on-ramps, so start with one of those. Take a minute or two to rest your attention on a sound, an object, or the breath, or use any other transitional activity that appeals to you. All right. Now allow your on-ramp activity to drop away. If your eyes are still open, you can close them. And here we are. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. We're already present, we're already aware. Rest in this awareness. That's all we'll be doing. Within this awareness, sounds come and go, colors come and go, sensations come and go, thoughts and feelings come and go. It all happens by itself. Perfect. Let whatever comes, come. Let whatever goes, go. See what remains. What remains is awareness, the conscious, open space within which everything else comes and goes. Just rest in that. That simple. Nothing else to do. Just rest in this unmoving awareness as everything else moves within it. This unmoving awareness, we could say, is like the ocean. The sensations and thoughts and all the other experiences we're aware of are like ripples and waves. Ripples come and go, waves rise and fall, But the ocean is always resting in its bed. No matter how much turbulence there may be on the surface, the ocean itself is always silent at its depth. So, just rest in this silent, ocean-like, completely ordinary awareness, and let the ripples and waves roll on, which they're going to do whether you let them or not. Notice that this ocean of awareness has plenty of room for whatever kinds of ripples or waves might come along. It doesn't pick and choose. It doesn't matter to awareness whether we see purple or brown behind our eyelids, or whether we hear the patter of the rain or the pounding of a car stereo, or even whether we feel tranquility or anxiety. Even intense emotions don't affect awareness itself. They're simply another experience we're aware of. Just remain like the silent ocean, as you already are, within which everything comes and goes on its own, unbidden, unopposed. Notice that thoughts are simply one more kind of wave passing through this ocean of awareness, just like sounds or sensations. There's nothing special about them and nothing to do about them. The content of your thoughts doesn't matter. Just as it doesn't matter whether we hear a seagull or a motorcycle, it doesn't matter whether we have thoughts about our love life or our grocery list, or for that matter, thoughts about our meditation. Hey, I'm doing great. Hey, I'm doing lousy. Just don't buy into the thoughts. Treat them like they're in a language you don't speak, or just part of the passing scenery. Don't engage with them, and don't try to push them away. If you try to push away the thoughts, you just wind up wrestling with them, which is another way of engaging with them. Anytime you realize you're hanging on to a thought or feeling or resisting it, just relax your grip and settle back into this ocean of awareness. Whatever's going on, don't much bother about it. Whatever. Just rest in this ocean of awareness, within which everything else comes and goes on its own. There's nothing to focus or concentrate on, nothing to evaluate or keep track of, nothing to figure out, nothing to strive for. Just remain as you are. And to remain as you already are, there's nothing to do. Just remain open and formless as the ocean, always resting in its bed, no matter what happens on the surface. Nothing more. That simple. Now, please easily notice what it is that tells you, in this moment, that you have a body. What immediate experiences tell you there's a body present? Well, there are some sensations, such as your breathing or the pressure of your back or bottom against the seat, as well as any aches or pains you may have. There may also be some mental images of the body, but our eyes are closed, so those are just memories, thoughts. And that's about it. Those are things you're aware of. But the you that's aware of them is not an ache or pain, an image or a thought. It just is. And yet it's aware. You are awareness. Everything else is something you're aware of. That includes the body. There's nothing to figure out here. Just notice. There's nothing to do. Just rest as awareness, as you already are. The silent, unmoving ocean of awareness is you. All the waves of motion and change, thoughts, feelings, sensations, pass frictionlessly through you. Just notice this. Leave it as it is, and let it go as it goes. This ocean-like awareness, you, is the most ordinary thing in the world. It's the most intimate, familiar thing in the world. Don't try to look for it. It's where you're looking from, and always have. Don't try to think about it. It's where you're always thinking from. Only for once, we're resting in it, resting as it, letting go into it, marinating in it. Notice that this awareness, this I, can be aware of different colors and forms, but it has no color or form. Notice that it's aware of sounds, but it's silent. Notice that it has no size, no shape, no density or texture, no inside or outside, no anything. Yet there's something good about it, something satisfying that naturally draws us to rest in it, to rest as it. Just rest as awareness. That simple. Now, keep your eyes closed and take a few minutes to gradually rouse the body back to an active state. When you feel ready, you can open your eyes. Good. You're it. Okay. Simple, right? All we did was notice that we're aware and then rest as that awareness. We notice that awareness is formless and unmoving, like the ocean. It's the transcendent, beyond the realm of change. Everything we experience moves within it, like waves, but the ocean is always resting in its bed. Of course, when we liken awareness to an ocean or the sky or anything else, that's just a metaphor. We're not trying to picture an ocean. If such pictures happen to come up, that's fine, but they're just thoughts like any others. Awareness is that space in which those thoughts and all thoughts innocently come and go. You're always already there. Remain as you are and rest there. It's that simple. We don't try to push away thoughts or anything else. We don't engage with thoughts or anything else. We don't try to feel some special way. And we don't try to meditate, whatever that means. We don't try to drive. We just kick back in the convertible and enjoy the scenery. As your tour guide, this time I did point out one important new element in the scenery, the fact that the awareness in which you rest and the you that rests in awareness are not two separate things. You are awareness. Usually we think of ourselves as a body or mind or role, so this new notion may sound kind of crazy. That's fine. You got a taste of it experientially, and that will keep getting clearer as you keep practicing. But it's really this simple. Who or what is aware of all this stuff? Aware of your thoughts, aware of your memories, aware of your perceptions. Who was aware of the pain of scraping your knee when you were 5? And the comfort of having mom put a Band-Aid on it? Who will be aware of the drawing of your last breath? Who's aware of this question? Why, you are. Duh, who or what else could it be? The possibility that you're not what you thought you were, but awareness instead, without color or size or name, is a radical, potentially life-changing one, which we'll revisit. But for now, please consider this, just hypothetically. If it turns out that what you are is boundless awareness, like the ocean or sky, and that all feelings, including fear, anxiety, anger, and addictive craving, pass through it frictionlessly, like a breeze or a wave, then that goes to the heart of our project. That should solve our problem. But don't take my word for it, or anyone else's. It's much too important. If it's true, sooner or later your own experience will confirm it. Come and see. For now, we just tweak our one fundamental meditation instruction, changing rest in awareness to rest as awareness. Then everything else happens by itself. As we've seen, the mind and body settle down by themselves, drawn by the gravitational pull of the silent awareness that we are at the depths of our being, by the peace and happiness that are the nature of that perfect, self-sufficient silence. Sometimes the settling and the peace are unmistakably clear, sometimes hazy. Either way, it's fine. That's not because sometimes we're doing a better job than other times, since we're not doing any job at all. It's just a natural unfolding that proceeds in its own way, in its own time. The big picture is that, through daily practice, our conscious contact with that peace and happiness grows stronger and clearer. That's what we've all been looking for all our lives. When we try to conceive of some ultimate, all-pervading, never-ending version of this happiness, we may give it grandiose names. Hardly daring to believe that such a version is possible, we may reserve those terms for religion, songs, myths, or cynical jokes. Shangri-La, the Holy Grail, the Rainbow Connection, Hakuna Matata, the peace that passeth all understanding, awakening, enlightenment, nirvana, heaven, deliverance, grace. Here's a simple name I like. Infinite okayness. Whether you're pushing your cart through the supermarket, looking for sweet strawberries and a perfectly ripened avocado, or strolling through the liquor store, looking for the beverage that will make you feel good, or at least less bad, or scrolling through your dating site, looking for the right partner for this lifetime, or at least a frisky hookup with no visible self-inflicted scars. In all these cases, and in all other cases, what you're really looking for is infinite okayness, endless happiness. Not knowing where to find it, you settle for the closest available facsimile. That's the story of our lives. We're always seeking the juice. That's how we're built, thirsty. Even when the juiciest thing available is just some mild diversion, gravity pulls our attention toward it. It's a reflex. That's why people text and drive, despite knowing better. What the sages teach, both the ancient sages and the contemporary ones I've been lucky enough to sit with, is that the true juice, the juiciest juice, the transcendental juice that doesn't depend on outer circumstances and therefore never runs dry, is inside you. Whether it's Jesus saying the kingdom of heaven is within you, or the Buddha telling you to look inside and find nirvana, or Socrates saying to know thyself and find the form of the good, it's the same message. That inner ocean of silent awareness is the fulfillment we've been looking for all along. But if we just suspend our own efforts for a little while, stop flailing around on the surface and creating more turbulence, we sink right in. Settling happens by itself. If we need to give this a name, we can call it meditation, natural meditation. But once we make this little shift of attention, the decision to rest as awareness, all we need to do is hang out. Just be fine with whatever presents itself in each moment, not trying to do anything about anything, and the irresistible, automatic mechanism of attention to the juiciest takes over. That's the kingdom of heaven coming like a thief in the night. That's gravity pulling the leaves to the ground, the dolce allowing us to far niente. And if it really turns out that this awareness is none other than you, then the dolce, the sweetness, what you've been looking for all your life, is the one who's been looking. But then you always find things in the last place you look. Know thyself indeed. Tag, you're it. Chapter 12. Every Little Thing. Let's summarize the elements of natural meditation. Sit comfortably. If desired, take any on-ramp for a little while, then let it go. Notice that you're aware, as always. Rest as this awareness, which is free and open like space, and leave settling to happen on its own. Let all experiences, thoughts, feelings, and sensations come and go frictionlessly within this awareness space. Anytime you find yourself resisting or holding on to anything, Just relax your grip and sink back into space-like awareness. After a while, take a few minutes to ease out slowly. Or, to summarize our summary, relax your grip and rest as awareness. If you remember nothing else about meditation, remember that and you'll be fine. That's it. You'll find that this is the single most effective thing you can do to find freedom from fear or anxiety, anger, addictive craving, and for that matter, grief, loneliness, shame, confusion, or any of the other afflictive emotions. Whether that sounds perfectly plausible to you or totally nuts doesn't matter. You just do it, and little by little, and sometimes a lot, you'll find those old tendencies loosening up and washing away. Every time you sit, the space of boundless okayness will reveal itself with some degree of clarity. Sometimes less, sometimes more. That doesn't matter either. In its own time, that okayness will infiltrate your whole life. All the supplemental methods and insights we'll introduce later are powerful too, but they'll be most powerful when practiced along with daily, nothing-doing, natural meditation. So, to help maintain this practice and answer questions that may crop up as you go along, here are some practical tips and fine points. You may want to return to this chapter from time to time for reference, kind of like a user's manual. This is where you might expect to find a list of do's and don'ts. But I don't much like the sound of that. Let's make it a list of don't worries. In fact, one excellent, concise, comprehensive, all-purpose meditation instruction is the one from Bob Marley. Don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing gonna be all right. Don't worry about the place. If you have a lovely little garden spot or a pleasant corner of your home where you like to sit, fine. But don't feel limited to meditating there. Because you don't have to sit in a special posture, and because you don't need silence, you can do it anywhere. The world is your meditation cave. Trains, buses, parks, theater seats before your movie begins, they're all in the cave. Don't worry about your posture. The lotus pose and the other classical sitting postures were developed in parts of the world that historically didn't have a lot of chairs. People were used to sitting on the ground. You can meditate sitting on a couch, chair, train seat, park bench, or anywhere else. In fact, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the founding text of the whole yogic tradition, doesn't even mention cross-legged poses or any of the other poses taught in most yoga classes. In prescribing the ideal asana, or posture, for meditation, it says, asana should be steady and enjoyable. Period. After some experimentation, most people conclude that the best way to keep things steady and enjoyable is to sit up and a little bit back, neither slouching nor stiff. If you can lie on your back without falling asleep every time, that's fine too. Further experimentation will also show you that sitting with your arms crossed or leaning forward with an elbow or two on your knees creates tension in the body. Sometimes when I lead a group session, no matter how many times I gently suggest, just sit back in your seat and let your hands drop loosely to your knees or lap, there'll be one guy, and yes, it's usually a guy, who keeps leaning forward in the thinker pose, which is indeed an excellent way to stay caught up in thinking. Or there'll be one who keeps his arms defiantly crossed in the bouncer pose, a great one for taking your macho stand and resisting anything unplanned or unexpected. If you're used to sitting in a cross-legged position on a cushion, that's great. There's something that can feel really fresh and invigorating about that, conducive to the restful alertness of meditation, if you're truly comfortable that way. Otherwise, instead of enjoying the ease of natural settling, you'll be working at maintaining your picture-perfect posture, and no one's taking pictures. It's a bit like those sex manuals with instructions for all the exotic positions that are supposed to bring you and your partner to the heights of orgasmic bliss. It turns out that it's much more important that the two of you just be comfortable and go into it with a relaxed, loving attitude and perhaps a sense of humor. Same deal here. Don't worry about the time. The first question that many people ask is, how long should I meditate? I usually reply, a while. If you're in a hurry, a little while. Others tell me something like, I'm up to 35 minutes a day and I'm working on getting to 40. Working indeed. My response is, forget about the time. When you're walking on the beach or soaking in a hot tub, basking, lazing, luxuriating, you don't set a timer. When you're dancing your butt off at a club or kicking back with your headphones, losing yourself in your favorite music, you don't grit your teeth and work your way up to 40 minutes. One of the best favors you can do yourself is to throw the clock out of your meditation space. Sure, if you need to leave for work or get the kids to school on time, you can set a quiet alarm. But otherwise, let yourself get lost in timelessness. The widespread idea that you need to meditate for an hour or more at a stretch to gain any benefit comes from the prevalence of unnatural meditation. If you're fighting the mind's natural gravity, straining to concentrate, you do have to keep at it till you finally get exhausted and gravity takes over, despite your efforts, not because of them. So, instead of 50 minutes of straining, followed by 10 minutes of letting be, we're going straight to the letting be. What is important is to sit every day, even if it's only for 5 or 10 minutes, or even just a minute or two, so that every day you're becoming more at home with the silence that underlies life's dramas and traumas and garden variety busyness. That's the one catch with this stuff. You have to do it. Of course, we're all busy, but everyone has a minute or two. Just don't be too lazy to relax. Get off your butt and get on your butt. You're never going to have the time or find the time. You have to take the time. Your old stresses and fears know that you've got them on the run now, and they don't want to be dislodged from their cozy niche in your psyche. They can invent all sorts of reasonable-sounding excuses for why you couldn't get around to it today, even for 1 minute. So, the best strategy is to make meditation part of your daily routine, just like brushing your teeth. Have a time when you always sit, right after your morning shower, or on your commute in the bus or train or rideshare, or on your coffee break, or when you get home from work and are unwinding before fixing supper. People often feel dull or sleepy after a big meal, so before meals may be safer. And then, don't limit yourself to that one dose. When you're stuck in a waiting room, instead of exacerbating your tedium by checking the time every 3 minutes, you can close your eyes, duck below the waves, and slip into yummy no time. As your contact with this space of being just grows, you can pepper your day with little mini-breaks and micro-breaks. When you're, say, at a party, feeling awkward because you don't know people and you're wondering, what am I doing here? You can discreetly close your eyes for a second or two and re-experience, ah, I'm just being. I'm in the place of always okayness. That's what I'm doing. Don't worry about sleeping. When I'm taking questions after a group session and a new meditator raises her hand with a particularly sheepish, apologetic look on her face, I know what's coming. I fell asleep. There's a widespread notion that falling asleep in meditation is some kind of cardinal sin. Nope, it's fine. The Dalai Lama has even said, sleep is the best meditation. If you consistently fall asleep in meditation, you should probably look into your sleeping habits at night. But in the unforced, uncontrived situation of natural meditation, we get what we need. And sometimes we need sleep. In fact, because the sleep that comes in meditation is launched from a level of such profound rest, it can be highly concentrated. I'm on planes a lot, leading workshops hither and yon, getting nice and jet-lagged, and I find that nodding out for a few minutes in meditation is deeply healing. In a pinch, it sometimes seems to compensate for a couple of hours of missed sleep. Don't worry about noise. One of the things I love about visiting New York City is meditating on the subway. Is it so I can exercise my yogic superpower of blocking out noise? Nope. It's so I can be reminded, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that noise is fine. Imagine, if you will, a couple of awakened sages. Let's say Jesus, the Buddha, and Ananda Maima, the bliss-permeated mother, riding the uptown A-train. We can almost taste their unbreakable tranquility, their spontaneous, lighter-than-air sense of infinite okayness. But when they get on the train, does that okayness evaporate? Do they say, "Gee, I was permeated by bliss till those brakes started squealing"? Of course not. Now, what's the difference between the sages and you? Do they have something going on that you lack? Actually, no. They lack something that you have, your struggle. They just don't resist what's there. Wherever they find themselves, they remain naturally wide open, letting everything pass frictionlessly through them. Now, we can't necessarily expect to become a 24/7 sage this week, but we're on our way. We start by being a sage for a few minutes a day, during our time of meditation. Your quiet little garden is fine for starters, but don't get stuck in it. Take your practice into the world. Bring on the jackhammers. At first, you'll find yourself mentally trying to push the jackhammers away, and that's fine. Sooner or later, you'll realize, deeply realize, that you can't. Then you'll give up, and you'll make a life-changing discovery. The great avant-garde composer John Cage, who wrote a fascinating book titled Silence, put it this way. Silence is not acoustic. It is a change of mind, a turning around. That is, the true silence, the deep silence we're seeking in meditation, the peace we've been seeking all our lives, actually, is not a mere absence of sound waves vibrating in the air and striking our eardrums. If it were, every deaf person would be enlightened. The real silence is the mind's turning within, to the core of our being, awareness itself. It's our always silent, oceanic depth, not some momentary flattening out of the surface waves. Very simply, noise is not a problem unless you make it a problem. In a way, we're already making it a problem just by labeling it noise. Try substituting the more neutral, non-judgmental word, sound. Then, when you realize you've been pushing against the sound, just gently let go of that pushing and relax again into your silent, oceanic self. Don't worry about thoughts. Good news! The idea that you have to empty your mind of thoughts is wrong. It's erroneous. It's also false, inaccurate, misguided, unfounded, untrue, unwarranted, deluded, misinformed, fallacious, at fault, all wet, off base, wide of the mark, and barking up the wrong tree. Did I mention that it's wrong? Yes, I'm trying to get your attention, because so many people have so much trouble hearing this. Thoughts are exactly like sounds, just not quite as loud. There's nothing wrong with their being there. With thoughts, as with sound, as soon as we stop making them a problem, they stop being a problem. When you have the thought, "I have to get rid of these thoughts," guess what that is? A thought. It's just a thought, exactly like the ones it thinks need to go. But as with sound, at first you probably will try to get rid of thoughts, and that's fine. You can take 10 minutes or 10 years, and eventually you'll come to the same conclusion. Thoughts will always be there in the mental field, just as sounds are there in the acoustic field and colors are there in the visual field, and that's perfect. Thoughts must be there because you're a human being and not a turnip. In one of his searching essays, Montaigne tried to observe and describe his own mind, finally concluding, "I cannot keep my subject still. It goes along befuddled and staggering with a natural drunkenness." This bears repeating. Mind is mental activity. By definition, it can't be still. It's waves. True silence is experienced when you rest in the ocean-like awareness that underlies and embraces the wavy mental field and all other fields. The Buddha didn't succeed in getting rid of his thoughts. He just sat under his tree until he gave up trying. And then, like all the sages, he discovered that he didn't have to get rid of anything. So, the practical application is simple. Don't try to push the thoughts away, but don't buy into them either. Just let them arise on their own and in time vanish on their own. When you realize that you're gripping a thought or anything else, simply relax your grip and sink back into the ocean of awareness, the experiencer, yourself. Don't worry about whether the thought persists. Background thoughts, ignore them. Foreground thoughts, relax your grip on them, and they'll fade into the background on their own. Others will come from the background to the foreground, but as long as you're not gripping them, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you think about. It doesn't matter what you think about what you think. It doesn't matter how little or how much you think. All thoughts are 100% irrelevant to resting as awareness. Your cleverest thought won't help you, and your dumbest thought can't hurt you. Just don't engage with the thoughts. Listening to your thoughts, buying into them, taking them seriously, is engaging with them. Trying to push them away is engaging with them. Trying to drown them out with a mantra or your breath is engaging with them. Trying to resolve your thoughts is engaging with them. Whether you're wrestling with the meaning of life or trying to remember who played the professor on Gilligan's Island, the feeling is usually, if I can just get this one thing resolved, then I'll be able to settle down. Hey, what was your must-resolve-now question 10 minutes ago? Anything you try to do with regard to thoughts is engaging with them. And that makes meditation supremely simple. You don't have to work out which kinds of engagement are helpful and which aren't. Just drop the whole thing. Forget about it. If you live in a city, you're already an expert on how to forget about it. You know how to automatically let the sounds of the traffic go on somewhere in the background of your attention and not bother about them. Your thoughts are just another kind of traffic, and you're not a traffic cop. Yes, sometimes a thought will move to the foreground and seize your attention, but then you can call on another of your expert urban skills. Deal with that demanding thought just as you deal with an aggressive lunatic you encounter ranting on the sidewalk. Don't buy into his rant, but don't try to argue with him or shoo him away. Just avoid eye contact and move on. In fact, not only is it okay that thoughts pop up, it's essential to our project of coming out of fear. It's how we can learn, deep in our bones, deep in our nervous system, that not every thought that comes along has to be believed or even seriously considered. That includes our fearful or angry or obsessive thoughts. In a sense, we're retraining ourselves to just let the thoughts boil away without grabbing the kettle, till they run out of steam and evaporate harmlessly into the air. Are there thoughts that need to be taken seriously and acted upon? Of course, but not right now. We deal with them after we open our eyes. You've probably heard of the power of now. This is where we exercise the power of later. For the moment, Don't try to remember who played the professor. Don't try to complete your shopping list. Don't try to work out your business plan. Don't try to make sense of your crazy family. Don't try to solve your health problems or your romantic problems. When you realize you're halfway through mentally writing an email or psychoanalyzing your sister-in-law, just relax, release your grip on that wave, and go on resting in the ocean. As the useless thoughts evaporate over time, it becomes clear which are the remaining useful ones. They're fewer than you might think. In fact, here's a little experiment. Take a pencil and paper, draw a line down the middle, and then for half an hour, simply watch your thoughts and keep score. Don't try to do anything about them. Just watch the thoughts and keep a tally of how many are useful. I should have my blue suit clean for that job interview. And how many aren't? What if I go on that job interview and sound stupid? You may be surprised. Our minds are a wonderful gift. They give us the capacity to contemplate atoms and galaxies, make cathedrals and symphonies, and avoid repeating the blunders of history. But they don't come with an off switch. They keep going and going and going, which can be frustrating, especially when we feel caught up in thoughts of worry or rage. But the experience of meditation teaches us that we can ignore our thoughts. They can keep going, but we don't have to go with them. By repeatedly ignoring them, you drain them of their power over you. You may have heard the popular meditation advice, find the space between thoughts. That one messes up a lot of people. It's like saying to find the space between waves. It usually leads to a lot of counterproductive effort. It's more helpful to say, rest in the space behind the thoughts. There's no waiting for that space. It's awareness, and it's you, the ocean that's always beneath the waves. Eventually, you realize that the thoughts themselves are made out of that space, just as waves are made of ocean water. They can never be an obstacle to it or an interruption of it. Sometimes you'll suddenly realize, oh, I've been so caught up on this long train of thoughts that I forgot I was supposed to be meditating. Now I've got to get off this train and come back. But while you're caught up in the thoughts, by definition, you don't know you're caught up, so there's nothing you can do about it. Then, when the light bulb moment comes and you realize that you've been caught up, by definition, you're no longer caught up, so there's nothing to do about it. And there's nowhere to go back to. You never left. All this quaint drama of getting on and off trains has been happening right here, in this awareness. Where else could it happen? And there's never anything to do about awareness but rest in it. The train has not and never can carry you anywhere. It's like a toy train on Christmas morning, under the pretty lights, going in circles round and round the tree. Sometimes you might even spend an entire session in frenetic, compulsive thinking, never once realizing you were caught up, never coming up for air. Then you might well think, that was a completely wasted sitting. I'm getting nowhere. But even this is okay. Many, many people have walked exactly this road before you and have found where it leads. The I'm getting nowhere moment is a standard stop along the way. If you just keep showing up, exposing yourself to the gravity, you'll gradually become less caught in the turbulence and do more sinking into the silent depths. It's physics. It can't not happen. Peace will assert itself. It has to. Which brings us to, don't worry about what's happening. Because the settling down that takes place in meditation happens in a gentle, natural, unforced way, we don't always realize we're settling. Researchers have found that whether a subject describes her meditation as deep and blissful or antsy and restless, the physiological symptoms of settling, such as changes in brain waves and metabolic functioning, are about the same. We've already seen that we don't control what's happening while we're sitting, and now we can see that we don't even know what's happening. We're in the passenger seat, and we're blindfolded. This is great news. It means we may as well relax about the whole thing. Mother Nature's driving, and we're just along for the ride. Sometimes you might have one of those wasted sessions, feeling like you've been caught up in one thought after another, or caught up in restlessness perking away like Mr. Coffee. But afterward, you have to admit that, hey, you feel kind of refreshed. If you happen to have an electroencephalography monitor, a galvanic skin response sensor, and a few other neurophysiologists' instruments handy, they'll show you that, objectively, you settled down. The moral, don't worry about what's happening. The point of meditation is not just to have a pleasant little eyes-closed excursion. It's about the transformation of day-to-day life. Over the long term, we become clearer, more rooted in inner silence, more balanced, less stuck in fear and speculation, more straightforward and confident. This is why we emphasize taking a minute or three before slowly opening the eyes at the end. Always assume that the physiological settling has been deep, so coming out too fast could actually be a bit of a shock to the system. Sometimes you might even feel like lying down for a while. This is also why, even though we're not setting some rigid length of time to meditate, it's not a good idea to bail out the moment you start to feel antsy or bored. It's working, whether it feels that way or not. The two essential meditation instructions are the same two commands you give your dog. Sit, stay. Don't worry about breathing. If you start a session with deliberate, slow ujjayi breathing, that's fine. After that, though, let the breath, like everything else, take care of itself. Sometimes, if you happen to notice, you'll realize you've barely been breathing at all. Because this reduced respiration is a spontaneous effect of deep rest, it's benign. In fact, it can be powerfully healing. Generally, when you're ill, your doctor will prescribe this or that medicine or therapy, but will also recommend bed rest. That, we could say, is because the body heals itself more effectively when its energy is available for self-repair, rather than being used for outer activity. In that sense, we can think of meditation as preventive medicine, a daily dose of concentrated deep rest. Many people report health improvements when they start sitting regularly. And in the long term, the rejuvenative nature of this deep rest tends to keep people looking and feeling younger. A prime example is the Dalai Lama, now in his 80s, but with a youthful, even childlike glow on the outside that clearly reflects how he feels on the inside. Don't worry about sensations, movements, or moods. Some people occasionally experience a spontaneous body movement during meditation, such as twitching or jerking of an arm or leg, or arching of the back. They may feel sensations such as tingling, lightness, heaviness, heat, cold, spinning, or floating. They may have a sharp intake of breath. Or they may have an unexpected change in mood, a sudden wave of anxiety or excitement or any other emotion, even laughing or crying. These phenomena are all duly noted and explained in the old wisdom traditions. They're part of a clearing process that meditation facilitates. The snakes are being sucked out the windows. Traumas register in the body. Our language acknowledges this. We say, dealing with my child's illness is a big weight on my shoulders. Renovating this house has become a real headache. The news from Washington made me sick to my stomach. My job is a pain in the neck. My boss is a pain in the ass. Over time, we store these traumas as a sort of neurological imprint or residue. But now, when we settle into the trauma-free zone of just being, the old residues start to loosen up and dissolve. This flushing out process can express, express, press out, as a physical movement, sensation, or mood.